Nōmai, haere mai. Welcome to Safe and Sound, New Zealand's animal rights radio show. Ko Sandra Kailaho, and this week I have much pleasure in presenting a very thoughtful interview that Paul Judge conducted with distinguished, long-time animal rights activist, co-founder and president of the farm animal rights movement, Dr. Alex Hirschhaft. Regular listeners to our show will know that last week we broadcast an excerpt from one of Dr. Hirschhaft's talks, where he drew parallels between the terrible injustices that the Jewish people suffered during the Second World War and what is happening every day to animals. We can hear that interview in just a moment, but first a quick word from our sponsor, Village Organics, here in Hamilton. This week, Ian and Brenda are promoting Butte Island Cheese. Yes, I said cheese and not cheese. There's nothing dairy about this product. It's a high-quality vegan cheese, and if you want to transition to an animal-free diet while demanding excellent value, pop along to Village Organics opposite the Frankton Hotel in Frankton. And now to the interview with Dr. Hirschhaft.
Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul.
Look, I understand that you are a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto.
That's correct.
Can you talk about your earliest memories of that time, and how old were you, and how did you manage to survive that horrific event?
I was five when the Nazis invaded Poland. This was September 1st, 1939. And Warsaw Ghetto was established about 6 months later. My major recollections from that period that I think are really worth mentioning, one is that our life had almost no value to anyone outside our immediate family. It certainly had no value to the Germans, and it didn't have much value to our neighbors, especially if it would affect their survival. Everybody was basically out for their own survival. In that sense, it was a very primal society. The other thing that was kind of notable and different is that we had different measures of success. So, for example, if we got to eat on a given day, that was a successful day. If we got not to get sick with typhus, which was epidemic at that time, that was a successful day. We had just different measures of success than normal societies.
I just can't imagine what it must have been like to live with death so sort of readily a fact right in your face growing up at that time as a sort of a very young child.
Yeah, well, it's a little easier actually for a child because you kind of don't know much different. And you also asked how I survived. We had a Russian maid, and she smuggled me out as her son.
I understand your mother survived, is that correct?
Yes, she did. Yes. She was able to join me outside the ghetto.
Afterwards. Right. So where did you end up going?
We ended up with my aunt. I had an aunt who was a famous dramatic actress in Poland. She had married her director, who was Polish, and she passed for a Gentile and for a Christian, and she never ended up in the ghetto. So I was able to end up in her apartment, and her partner was active in the Polish underground, and he was able to get us false papers so that we could exist outside of the ghetto.
So you stayed in Poland until for the duration of the war?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. There was no means to travel outside the country.
And that itself must have been rather horrific with the way the war progressed and the Russians coming through and everything.
The Russians liberated us.
Yes, of course. So, but it was still a very violent time, wasn't it? I mean, it was just...
Yes, it was.
How did you manage to get food in the ghetto?
Mostly because of our Russian maid. So she became a member of a white Russian society, which was flourishing in Poland, because the Nazis had plans to invade Russia, and they assumed that the white Russians would be their puppets in running the country. The white Russians, of course, came on the losing end of the Russian Revolution, and they exiled to Poland, and there was a large colony in Warsaw. So our maid became a member because she wanted to maintain cultural ties with the Russian language and literature. When the ghetto was formed, just as Jews had to move into the ghetto, Gentiles were not allowed to be in the ghetto, and she refused to leave us because we were her only family. So she went to the White Russian Society, and they gave her permits to not only go in and out of the ghetto, but also to bring food. That's basically how we survived. Yeah.
Now, you're animal rights activist now and have been for a while, and I just wondered if you could talk about the story. There is a story which you tell about being a water quality inspector and you went to a slaughterhouse. Is that correct?
Yeah. After the war, I had several basic problems, which I guess some people call survivor's guilt. First of all, I wanted to make some sense out of the terrible tragedy that I had just lived through. And I also, even though I'm not a religious person, I was wondering why I survived when so many other good people did not, and how I could repay the debt for having survived. I know these are strange questions, but they were bothering me a lot. And I really didn't have a good answer until in 1972, I moved to Washington, and because I have a PhD in chemistry, I went to work for a consulting firm, and my specialty was wastewater management, and they sent me to a slaughterhouse in the Midwest to do an inventory of their wastewater problems. And I was walking around taking notes, and I turned a corner, and I saw these piles of heads and hearts and hoofs, you know, just kind of living testimonials to living sentient beings who were no more. And it's one thing to think of death in the abstract, but when you actually confront a pile of body parts, in my case, I immediately drew comparison with the piles of hair and glasses and suitcases and clothes that I saw in Auschwitz after the war of my fellow Jews who were murdered and cremated there.
You saw these. You didn't see photographs of them. You actually went to Auschwitz and saw them.
Yes, yes. You know, at first I tried to dismiss it. You know, I kept saying, well, these are just animals. But the more I thought about it, the more I saw the parallels, the use of the victim's skin to record a number, an identification number, just as we brand animals on their skins. The use of cattle cars to transport Jewish victims to the death camp of Treblinka. The secrecy behind the death camp wall and behind our slaughterhouse walls, and the deception and the housing of the victims in wood crates. There were just
so many
parallels, yes, that I couldn't get away. And of course, I didn't know anyone who shared my concerns and my feelings till I finally saw a quote by Isaac Bashevis Singer, who said that for the animals, all men are Nazis, and life is an eternal Treblinka. And to see somebody with that kind of authority share my views was a huge relief, a great deal of relief to me internally, because I finally knew that there was a reason for me to survive and that there was a way for me to repay my debt. And basically, I set out to spend the rest of my life in fighting all forms of oppression. This was the lesson for me of the Holocaust, to start with the oppression of the most vulnerable sentient living beings on Earth, which is the animals, and particularly the animals raised for food.
What kind of reaction have you had from people when you've talked about this in the public forums?
I talk about it maybe, you know, a few times a year by special invitation, and the audiences are usually people who already agree with me, and if they don't, they generally don't want to hear about it. But that brings up, you know, this this idea of comparing the moral worth of victims, that really is at the very root of why we are not getting rid of oppression. Because all of the work against oppression, if you think about it, revolves around the victims. And there is actually a contest of victimhood. People who have suffered for one reason or another are comparing themselves with other victims. And they basically say that their suffering, their victimhood, is greater than somebody else's victimhood. And there is this cult of victimhood, this hierarchy of moral worth. And the problem is that all of this focuses on the victims. Mm-hmm. And the victims are not the issue. The issue is the oppressive mindset. What is it that makes it possible for people to start discriminating between one sentient living being and another? Where does it start, and how do you stop it? That's what we should be looking at. That's what we should be confronting, not wondering whether the suffering of African Americans is greater than that of Jews, mm-hmm. or the greater than that of Bosnians in Yugoslavia, or animals in the slaughterhouse. Not about the victims.
You're with Safe and Sound, New Zealand's Animal Rights Show. Paul Judge is speaking with Dr. Alex Hirschhaft, co-founder and president of the Farm Animal Rights Movement.
There's an animal rights activist, an academic in Massachusetts, the university there, called John Sanborn Matsu. He's an American-Japanese academic, and he writes about the connection that you've made there between the Holocaust and the animal industrial complex. And he says the sort of conjoining of the ruthlessness, the joy of the killing, or the mechanization of the killing, if you like, as well, he mentions, and the sheer helplessness and terror of the victim. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Would you agree with that?
Not quite. In the instances of oppression that I'm familiar with, which is obviously that of the Holocaust and that of the animal slaughter, and the instances that I know of third hand through news accounts, I don't see that there is any particular joy on the part of the oppressors. What happens is basically victimization fills a basic human need. Most of us evaluate our worth and our self-awareness by comparing ourselves with others. And imagine an athlete who specializes in high jump, if I may draw this analogy. There are two ways that he can succeed in the next jump. He can train for weeks and weeks and weeks at great cost to his personal health and time and well-being, or he can lower the bar, which is a lot easier and a lot simpler. And basically, a lot of people, in evaluating their self-worth, rather than trying to achieve more in life and being a better person, they just find somebody else in their surroundings that they feel better than. And once they find that, then they basically view themselves as being superior to that other being. Now, a lot of it is not out in the open because society does not permit that. But what happened in Germany was that Germany in the 1930s was very humiliated, of course, by their loss in World War One and the Versailles Treaty, and their currency was going nuts. A lot of people were very distressed economically. And most of your listeners may not realize that, but in Europe, there were no distinct minorities other than the Jews. You know, in America, this would be unthinkable because there are so many Asians and Africans and South Americans. But in Europe, in the 1930s, the Jews were the only minority, the only ones who could be basically put down as victims. And where does it start? So, children naturally have a great affinity for animals. Animal toys are the very first things they handle. when they grow up, all the fairy tales that they read revolve around animals. So children naturally evolve a great deal of affinity towards animals. And then at some point, they look at the food on their plate and they say, "Mommy, what is this?" And basically what they're told at that point is that the dog on their couch is to be cherished and fed and loved, and the pig on his plate is to be abused and murdered and cut into little pieces and consumed as food. And this is the first inkling that the child gets that society has the power to make the determination that one sentient living being gets to live and to be loved and cherished, and another, fairly similar, must die. This is the very root of discrimination, where the notion that two living beings that are apparently very similar, that one must live and one must die.
This is what we call speciesism, of course, isn't it? I mean, this is exactly what it is, and it's akin to racism.
It isn't even speciesism. It's just so arbitrary. Mm. This is what was so amazing, is that the Jews in Poland and in Germany were very assimilated. My own family was extremely assimilated, and it was very hard to tell the Jews apart from the Christians.
Right.
Only the neighbors knew. And the tragedy is that it's not really speciesism, because we looked alike, we were the same species, and yet they found a way. And this is the same tragedy. I mean, look at what happened in Rwanda with the Hutu and the Tutsi, and in Serbia with the Bosnians. I mean, these people were neighbors. They were totally alike. They traded, they lived together, until one decided that the other would become a victim.
But I think the similarity to violence against animals is that thing where that I think the point that John Sandman Matsu is making is that that it's the domination over one particular group, isn't it? That you render worthless through cultural ideologies and so on.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly the similarity, isn't it, between what happened to the Jews and what happens to pigs over dogs.
The victim must not have value.
That's right.
Yes.
It's an utter devaluing. I witnessed a hunting show, a television show, where they shot a beautiful chamois goat up in the Southland mountains of our country here. And, you know, in Southland, they hunt these animals, which have been introduced for the purposes of hunting. When I mentioned joy before, I really connect with what Sandman Matsu is saying about that, because there's these shots of these hunters after they've shot this beautiful, beautiful animal who's just doing nothing wrong, just being an animal in the wild and just didn't even know these people were there. You know, how can you call that a sport? They shoot this animal, it dies in a violent way, and then they're sort of shaking each other's hands and patting each other on the back and these big grins and talking about how wonderful their experience has been. And I just wondered, there is such a violence to that, isn't there? And there's such a ruthlessness to that.
Yeah, but this is not the norm. This is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is totally normal, upstanding citizens, leaders of their community, committing unspeakable acts routinely without giving it a second thought, which is basically what we're doing here with animals. Every time we shop for food,
we are
subsidizing unspeakable atrocities, and we're not taking any joy. I mean, when we look at pictures and videos, we're horrified.
Mm. We are. We truly are.
This is the tragedy. It's not about these sickos who go shooting animals. It's about the normal, everyday people, your best friends, your family, who subsidizes these atrocities every day.
You're right. That's the tragedy of it, isn't it? And so the only real answer to it is to not indulge in the consumption of animal products.
Well, that's a start. I mean, we cannot achieve our basic humanity until we basically drop consumption of animals from our menu. I mean, that's an essential first step.
I think that's a wonderful thing that you've said there. So you do believe then, quite profoundly, obviously, you believe that humans are capable of transcending this condition of violence towards animals, towards each other, violence per se. Can we transcend it?
I don't know. I don't know whether we can. I think that the first step in ending the wholesale slaughter of animals will be the scarcity of resources. I think that the world will basically have to go to a plant-based diet just simply for scarcity of the resources required to support a meat-based society. You see, here's an interesting thing. If you look at all the social justice movements, like for women, for gays, for children, in every case, basically what we were asking people to do is to stop hating, stop discriminating. We did not really ask people to change their lifestyle in any way. When we asked them to support animal rights, their first answer is, oh, yeah, I love animals. I have this lovely dog in my house. And yeah, I support you. Do I have to do anything? Yeah, you have to change your diet 3 times a day. Oops. No, I'm not ready. But once we change the food system, once people are forced to eat plant-based because of simply the lack of resources, when we then ask them to support animal rights, then it'll be a lot easier to gain converts.
Yes, and I think it is about the resources. I think you're exactly right there with the way the planet heading with climate change and so on. We're in this country at the moment, we're experiencing heat in December, which we normally experience in February. And I think the farmers, they're shocked. They're freaking out at these temperatures, you know, and of course they're sending all their poor animals off in the trucks to be slaughtered earlier than they would like. And this kind of thing, because they're worried about the drought kicking in and they won't have feed for them or water for them. We've said a number of times on this program, we predict the end of animal agriculture in this country at least, and in many other parts of the world. I think animal agriculture will be unsustainable.
Well, it is already.
Yes, I agree. Can you tell us a little bit about your diet and how you've actually become a vegan, and how you know what kind of vegan tips can you give us in terms of?
I became a vegan in 81, you know, as part of my work on behalf of animals. It was really the only choice. And my diet is pretty simple. The office of my organization is in my home, so my staff comes to my house to work, and they buy the food, and I just, when I'm hungry, I open the refrigerator, see what's there. Either heat up some frozen veggies or have a salad of some kind. Occasionally, I will have some plant-based meats, you know, that are becoming very popular in America. That's basically my diet, but I also make sure I exercise every day. I either swim or jog or dance. And I'm 83 years old, and most people think I'm in my late 50s.
That's incredible. That's so impressive, I have to say. It's an inspiration to us. We're going to have to wind this up because we're running out of time, but I just wonder if we could talk a little bit about your organization. Farm?
Yeah, it's Farm for short. It stands for Farm Animal Rights Movement. And basically what we do is we show videos of factory farms and slaughterhouses to young people and ask them to adopt a plant-based diet. There are a lot of variations of this, but that's our basic mission. The other thing that sets us apart from other organizations is that we put on the annual Animal Rights Conference in the United States, which actually has become the world's largest animal rights conference. We have about 1,700 people who attend each year, with about 150 speakers and 80 sessions and about 100 exhibitors. So it's quite a major event, and we do this for the entire movement. We have been doing this actually since 1981.
I'd love to come to that conference. Where do you hold it? In different cities around the States?
That's the general idea, but we ended up alternating between Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles just because we're familiar with the hotels. Those are two big airports, and the prices are not too outrageous.
You get international speakers?
Yeah. The last one, we had representatives from 12 countries. I don't know if we had anyone from New Zealand.
I think we're going to have to apply, put a paper forward.
It's arconference.org.
Okay. When's the next one?
The next one is June 28th in Los Angeles.
We'll try and get there, eh? But anyway, I'm going to wrap it up now. And I'm going to say thank you very much for being on our show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Fantastic talking to you, and so I feel honoured to have been talking to you today. And
thank you.
I hope we can meet up sometime.
And, I'd like
hopefully next year in LA, we'll look into coming over.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for calling.
What a wonderful man, a pioneer in the animal rights movement. In case you're wondering about the music we've been playing in the program, it's the Adagio in G minor, attributed to Albinoni, and Alex's choice for the show. We'll listen to a little bit more of it now, but not before I dedicate the show to the Russian maid whose devotion to Alex's family saved his life. Kakitiano. See you next week. Bye-bye.